Once again, turn to Romans chapter 1. It's going to be in verses 20 to 25 starting out tonight. And then later on, we'll go to the book of John. But we've been looking at the church. We've been looking at what the church is all about. We've been looking at the first century church that turned their world upside down. And as we've looked over the past couple weeks at the principles that set it into motion, if you remember, I pointed out four qualities that are found in Acts chapter 2 that set apart the first century church. And that is, number one, they were a learning church. And we've studied that for the past 2 weeks, what it means to be a learning church, to study the Bible, to be students of the Word of God. Number two, they were a loving church. And we're going to look at that in a couple weeks. Number three, they were a worshiping church. And number four, they were an evangelistic church. Now, I pointed out last week that if you want to be a strong Christian, you need to apply these same principles personally. Now, these principles set apart the church as a whole, but these same principles also set apart real, living Christians from false hypocrites. Now, you must be a learning Christian. You must be a loving Christian. You must be a worshiping Christian. And you must also be an evangelistic Christian. Now, all four of these have to be true in your life if you want to consider yourself a living, real Christian. Now, what I mean by that is a lot of people only want one and not the other. For instance, a lot of people get really excited about passionate worship. And so all they want to do is worship. They don't really want to hear the Bible. They don't really want to evangelize. And they don't really, you know, love. Okay, they can do that. But that's about it. Now, there's other ones who really love coming and hearing the Bible studies. They love hearing the Word of God. They love learning, but they're not really into worship. They don't like being passionate. They don't like, you know, singing songs. And they have a hard time loving people. There's those people in their lives they just really don't like, and so they don't want to be involved with them. Then there's other Christians, actually most Christians, who don't really want to evangelize. Let's be honest really quick. This has nothing to do with the message tonight, but just be honest. Who's scared of evangelism? Be honest. I'm scared of evangelism at times. It's a scary thing, right? Going up to somebody you don't know and saying, hey, do you know about Jesus Christ? Can I tell you about him? Well, what if they ask me the question? What's the question? Can God create a rock so big that he can't lift it? What if they ask me that question? I don't know how to answer that. Or what if they ask me, is the Holy Spirit like an apple or an egg? I don't know. Or the Trinity, how does that work? Or what the Garden of Eden, where is that? What if they ask me a question I don't know? And a lot of people are scared of evangelism. A lot of Christians don't want the whole package. They only want part of the package. Well, we're going to look at all of these parts over the next couple of weeks. But tonight we're going to focus on one. And we're going to consider one of these principles. And that is that they were a worshiping church. And tonight we're going to ask the question, our sermon title is, what is worship? What is worship? What does it mean to worship? Why is worship important? What is it about worship that is so valuable and critical to the Christian life? Before we move on, I want to point something out. We as human beings were created to worship. You were created to worship. God formed you and God made you as a being who needs to worship something. And when you get down to it, every human being ever created worships something. Now, we don't all worship God in heaven, but we all worship something or someone. Some people worship people. Some people worship heroes, actors, musicians, etc. Some people worship their possessions, the things they have. Others worship themselves. Some people worship the things that they do becomes their source of worship. A good way that you can tell if you're worshiping something is ask yourself, what is on my mind all day long? What am I thinking about when I get home? What is it that I want to do when I think that I have free time or I have time to myself? What is it that consumes my thought life? There's a good chance that's what you worship. You know, there's some people that get consumed with hobbies. You know, there's people who, instead of going to church on Sundays and any other day of the week, they're golfing on those days of the week. Or there's other people that they're watching football games when they could be learning from the Lord, or when they could be communing with the Lord. There's others who are buying things. They're trying to fill the void with clothes or with cars. Others worship their job, making more and more money to achieve something in life. Now, there's also things that are good that you can worship. You know, some people worship their families. That becomes the one thing in their life that they think about. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't think about our families. We should. As we grow older, as we get a wife, as we get a husband, as we have children, we should be caring for those. But we should always keep God as number one. Keeping in mind that if we keep Him number one, it will keep everything else together. It's when we get our priorities unbalanced and we think that if we focus so much on this one thing, it's going to make it better. But when we take our eyes off God, it actually in turn makes it worse. You know, it's incredible what America worships. You can see what America worships by watching television and seeing the ads that are given to us in America. And I would say, from the looks of it, we worship alcohol, fast food, and razors is what it looks like we worship, because that's what I see mostly on television. But America has things that we worship. I mean, think about one of the most popular television shows right now, American Idol. I mean, they say it in their title, Idol. We want you to worship these people. They're your idols. Look to them. You know that in the year that President Bush was elected to presidency, more people voted for American Idol than they did for the presidential election that year. Literally, more people voted for American Idol than for the presidential election that year. It shows really quickly what we worship. Everybody worships. Everybody, everywhere. And that is because worship is the fundamental drive of life. Atheists worship. Infidels worship. Skeptics worship. Republicans and Democrats worship. Insurance agents and lawyers worship. Everybody worships. So my question for you tonight is, what do you worship? I want you to think about that, and I want you to answer that before we move on. Think about in your life, what consumes you? What defines you? What is it in your life that takes up your time, that takes up your finances, that takes up your thought process? What is it in your life that you get your primary source of joy from? Put all of that together and ask yourself, what is it that you are worshiping? You know, all people worship because worship is the fundamental difference between humans and animals. And that is to say, animals do not worship. Animals don't worship things. They live off of instinct. They don't have a sense of eternity. My dog doesn't sit in the backyard thinking about the love and holiness of God as he looks at the skies and the mountains and says, man, there's got to be a creator. He doesn't do that. He sits in the backyard, he thinks about food, his yard, and our family as his servants and how to ruin our lives. That's all he thinks about. He thinks about ways to make me angry, that I can sin in my heart as I yell at him. That's what my dog thinks about. He doesn't worship. He doesn't ponder godliness. He doesn't ponder holiness. But in contrast, the Bible says that God has placed eternity in man's heart. Once again, it doesn't matter who you are, everybody wants something more. We have this ingrained in us from a very young age. What we have isn't enough and we want something more. Let me tell you, that's an epidemic that doesn't change no matter how much money you get. No matter how many cars you have, no matter what house you have, no matter how hot of a spouse you have, it never changes the need and the desire to want something more, to want something better. This is God placing eternity in our hearts, the desire for something more. The book of Ecclesiastes tells us the story of Solomon, a man who wanted something more. A man who had eternity placed in his heart, and he sought that fulfillment in everything, in women, in money, in a house, in control, in power, in everything that he could set his eyes upon. And in the end he said, all is vanity. All is vanity. There's nothing under the sun that pleases. All is vanity. And it's this urge that causes people everywhere to worship. If we are not worshiping the true God, then we are worshiping a God of our own composition, a God of our own development. Hideyoshi, a Japanese warlord who ruled Japan in the 1500s, commissioned a colossal statue of Buddha for a shrine in Kyoto. And it took 50,000 men 5 years to build. But the work had really scarcely begun to get completed when an earthquake in 1596 brought the root of the shrine crashing down and it wrecked the statue. In a rage, this man, Hide, I don't even know how to pronounce his name. Let's just call him Hide. There you go. Hide shot an arrow at the fallen colossus and he shouted this, "I put you here at great expense and you can't even look after your own temple. I put you here at great expense. I put my time, my effort, my money, everything that I had into you, and you can't even protect your own temple." You know, I've realized that human beings say this in their lives often to their own gods. Once again, their gods might not be Buddha. It might not be the God of heaven and earth, but it might be something of their own creating. It might be their money. It might be their family, it might be their house, it might be their job. And when that structure comes crumbling down, when things break down in their lives, their response is catastrophic because everything that they have is placed into that subject. Everything they have is found in whatever they've spent all their time and their energy in. And when it comes crashing down, they get so angry. They get so indignant. They don't know what to do. They don't know where to turn. They lose hope. They lose joy. They lose everything that they've founded their life upon. And their response is, "I gave all of my time, all of my energy to this, and it couldn't even hold up, couldn't even stand up under pressure." So again, what is it in your life that you are worshiping? What is your God? See, the true God, the one who hears and sees, is unlimited in power. And not only can he take care of his own temple, but he built his own temple and he built you too. I want to point that out. God doesn't have need of you. God isn't some megalomaniac sitting in heaven that he needs your worship or he's going to like implode and have like a nervous breakdown and get depressed and sit in his bathroom looking in the mirror telling himself he doesn't look good enough. God's not going to do that. He's not in need of your worship. He doesn't live off of your worship. Instead, God loves you with such a passionate, deep love, the way that a husband or a wife loves one another when they first say those marriage vows. And so his desire for you to worship him is the desire of a husband and a wife that would have in a marriage, a passionate love, desiring that the other one would have that same love for them. You know, the word worship comes from the Old English word, which literally was worth-ship, which means to ascribe worth or value to something or someone. So now again, let's reframe the idea of what are you worshiping? The definition is to ascribe worth or value to something or someone. So when I ask you, what do you worship? The question is, what are you ascribing the majority of your value or your worth in your life to? What is it in your life that you ascribe the most worth to, the most value to? Now, we as Christians worship that which is worthy. We ascribe worth to that which deserves it. A God of our own making is not worthy of our worship. Why? Simply because they'll disappoint. We already said that. If we spend all of our time, our energy, our resources in something that we have created, it will let us down. It will disappoint us because everything disappoints. Who in here in life has been disappointed before? Good. If you're not raising your hand, I'm so jealous of you right now. But disappointment's a part of life. It comes. We experience it. We can actually anticipate more of it. Guess what? You're going to be disappointed later on. I don't know when, but you're going to. It's going to happen. It's part of life. And the reason you're going to be disappointed is because you look for worth or value, or you look for identity, or you look for joy in something here on earth. And when that lets you down, you'll be disappointed. If you just didn't care about anything, nothing would matter. You know, I watched a show, one of the shows that I watch on Thursday nights. I always TiVo them and I come home and I watch them. I love to watch The Office. I love to watch Parks and Recreation, and The Community. And those are the three shows that I watched. And Community is getting really weird, and I'm probably not going to watch anymore. It's just strange. But I watched an episode of that, and there was this creepy guy who worked at a fair. And one of the people in the show really liked him, and they had a crush on him. And this other guy was trying to figure out why he was so cool. And he said, "Why are you so cool? What is it about you that people like?" And his response was this. He said, "Well, can I be honest with you? I got shot in the head with a nail one time, and it hit a nerve in my body that now I don't care about anything. So I have no inhibitions, I do whatever I want, I'm not embarrassed, and I just don't care." And literally, that was what made him so cool. Unfortunately, unless you and I want to like take a nail gun to our head and lobotomize ourselves, that's not going to happen. We care about things. We care about how we look. We care about people that we hang out with. We care about how we're perceived. It's part of the human epidemic. And because of that, we will be disappointed. Revelation chapter 5, verse 12 says, "In a loud voice they sang, 'Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise.'" That is one of the best descriptions that God can get. Worthy. God is worthy. He is worthy of our ascribing worth to Him. He is worthy of honor and praise and wisdom and strength. There's a number of words in the Bible that are translated into worship. The one used most often is the word shekhah, which means to bow down and to give homage to. To bow down and to give homage to. Think of it when you watch a television show and there's kings, there's monarchy. And when someone comes to the king or the monarchy, they bow down. They prostrate themselves. They pay homage to that king. Oftentimes bringing a gift for being in the presence of the king or in the presence of that ruler. This word is first used in Genesis chapter 18 verse 2 where Abraham bows down before his three visitors. Remember that story? Three visitors come to Abraham. He bows down. One of them he later discovers is the Lord himself. Another word used for worship is the word prosduneo, which literally means to kiss towards. It conveys the idea of showing reverence. Now putting these two together, we can receive a general idea of what worship is and what worship should be. First of all, we worship God because He is worthy. And in doing so, we bow down and pay homage to Him. That speaks of reverence and respect for God. And yet we also kiss towards Him, which speaks of tenderness and intimacy. Jesus made it very clear that there is both a right and a wrong way to worship. There's two different ways. One's good and one's bad. There is both true and false worship. Remember the Pharisees who thought that they were experts at worship were by and large not even close to what worship was supposed to be. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 8 and 9, Jesus said, "These people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." We should not worship God because of what we'll get out of it. We shouldn't worship God because we think we're going to get blessed or because we think we're going to get cool stuff if we worship Him. Again, God should not be treated the way that our parents are treated. What I mean by that is when you're a little kid and you do chores, you often do chores because you're going to get something good. I remember when I was a little kid, they said, "Hey, if you do chores, then you get to like go to the zoo or something. Or if you do your chores, if you do this for us, we'll do this for you." And I had like an allowance. The only way I could get my allowance is if I cleaned the poop, did the dishes, took the trash out, did all this stuff. Then I got my allowance. Now, would I have done any of that stuff if I did not get something in return? No. Now, my parents probably would have beat me if I didn't. But the point was, I didn't have any desire to do that. I wasn't like, "Man, I'm so stoked I get to clean dog crap today. It's going to be awesome. It's going to smell sweet." No, that wasn't my mentality. I was very against dog feces at that age. Still am. But I didn't look forward to it. I didn't want to do it. I did it because I got something in return. A lot of people worship God the same way. They don't really want to go to church. They don't really want to read the Bible. They don't really want to worship. They do it because they think they're going to get something out of it. It's like fire insurance. They do it because they really just are kind of scared of hell, And they think that if they go to church once a week and get all their sins hidden under the rug, that they're going to be good. Hey, you're clear to go. Come on into heaven. And that's what's going to happen. And it's the wrong motivation to worship. And Jesus has some strong words to say to that motivation in the Bible. A.W. Tozer says, "Whoever seeks God as a mean towards desired ends will not find God. God will not be used." There's another epidemic with human beings. We have a tendency to use people, right? Who in here has ever been used by somebody for something? Who in here has ever used somebody for something? Be honest. You raised your hands for being used. You can't, like, plank in your own eye kind of a thing going on there. I have, and we have a tendency to use people. We have a tendency to get what we want from somebody and then leave them. Get out of there. We have a tendency to see what we want, do whatever we need to do to get it, and then go back to the way our lives should be. Worship affects every aspect of our lives. Turn to Romans chapter 1, verse 20, and let's read our text. Romans chapter 1, starting in verse 20. Paul tells us, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like the corruptible man, and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen." Now, I said before, we have the right way to worship and the wrong way to worship. This is the wrong way to worship. And we see four steps down here in this passage. When we fail to worship God, it will affect every area of our life. And we see that progression here. Number one, failing to glorify God. Romans 1:21 says, "Although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God." This is the first step in a downward spiral of destruction and despair that ultimately leads to death. This is the basic expression of the root sin of pride. I want to point out, pride is at the core of man's failings. It's at the core of man's sinfulness. It's at the core of what leads us into sin and temptation. It's pride. Wanting something more, wanting to be something, wanting to have something, wanting to be with someone because it makes us feel a certain way. It's pride. We think we deserve a certain thing, and so we'll do whatever we have to do to get it. This leads to lying because we're scared and we're prideful and we don't want to be caught in that lie. It leads to theft. It leads to adultery. It leads to murder. Pride can usually be found at the root of most sin. Now, this might not seem like a serious sin to you, but it is to God. When there is a breakdown here, other problems will always follow. When we fail to glorify God, other problems will always follow. I want to point out, it was a failure to do this that resulted in idolatry and immoral living for King Belshazzar in the book of Daniel. The prophet Daniel came to him with this reproof in Daniel chapter 5, verse 23. He says, "You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand, and the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified." Scripture continually exhorts believers to do this. Psalm 29, verse 1 through 2 says, "Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name." 1 Corinthians 10:21 says, "Whether you eat or drink, do all or whatever you do for the glory of God." So the first step in a downward spiral is a failure to glorify God, a failure to do what we were created to do. And that leads to the second, number two, which is a failure to give thanks. A failure to give thanks. Now, this is inevitable, because if you don't glorify God as God, then you won't give thanks to God for what he's given you, right? If you're your God, if something else in your life is your God, then your thanks aren't going to be given to the true God, it's going to be given to yourself. Again, Romans 1:21 says, "Nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened." You know, I want to point out on something that's really brushed off nowadays. It's not considered very important, but many Christian homes, many Christians in general, have neglected to give thanks. Now, this is going to sound stupid. You're going to say, "Are you serious? That's so petty." But I think it's important. We failed to give thanks at mealtime. And I know from a little kid, from a young age, we're taught to say grace before we eat, say our prayers before we go to bed. But many of us don't do it because we think it's unnecessary. We think we've grown up. We don't really need to do it. But what a wonderful habit it can be, and what a wonderful example it can be to those around you, to people that see you when you go out to eat in public, to your friends who might not be believers, to your family. Simply thanking God for what he has given you is something so simple but so overlooked. What it does, in a very simple way, whether you're in public or whether you're in private, it shows whoever's around you that what you have and what you worship is not yourself, but it's God. And that you ascribe to God all the blessings that are in your life. So simple and yet so meaningful. You know, Daniel the prophet was in a regular habit of giving thanks to God. And even after he knew that it could result in his arrest and execution, Daniel 6:10 says, "Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows were open towards Jerusalem, and three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God just as he had done before." In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God. You know, whenever my wife and I, Janae, go out to eat, I always notice when a family prays together. And it's always super cool to see. We'll be at a restaurant, and we'll be sitting down, and I love to people watch, so I'm always watching, looking out for people, scoping out the situation, and I always focus on a family when I see them praying, or a couple when I see them praying and giving thanks, and I always point out to Janae, I'm like, "Janae, look at, she's like, what, and I'm like, "Isn't that cool? They're praying," and she's kind of like, "Yeah, okay, we do that," but I'm like, no, they're praying, they're in public, and people are watching them, and they're praying. You don't really see that often. Think about that. How often do you really see people praying in public when they sit down to eat? It doesn't happen that often. When's the last time you, with your friends, before you guys ate dinner, prayed and gave thanks to the Lord? It's a rarity. It doesn't happen that often. But after every single meal, every time I see that happen, I always stop at the table and I let them know how nice it is to see people pray in public. And I always thank them. I say, I want to thank you. Because it's little things like that show that Christianity is still alive and well in America. It's little things like that are little proclamations that, hey, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So number one, when we fail to glorify God, it leads to failing to give thanks. And number three, failing to glorify God and failing to give thanks leads us to turn to other gods. Romans 1:21, again, it says, "Nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things." So this is the third thing that we do that leads in a downward spiral. Because God is removed, because we no longer glorify God, because we no longer give thanks to God, because he is removed, something or someone must take his place. Again, I said, everyone worships. Everyone has something in their life they ascribe worth to. So if God isn't in that place, something else is in that place. People turn to other belief systems to seek to appease a guilt-ridden conscience. A religion or belief that will rationalize my lifestyle. And that's what they do. They look at their lifestyle and they say, "I don't want to change, so what religion will work with the way I live?" Not how can I change myself to be pleasing to God, but what God will accept me in the exact way that I am so that I never have to change, but I can continue to live the way that I want. And they'll pick whatever religion fits them. And that at this point is usually becoming increasingly sinful. You know, there's some crazy religions out there today. There's some crazy things that people do in the name of their God today. There's some crazy things that happen in the name of religion or belief systems. Many cling to the teachings of New Age type religions because they basically accommodate their lifestyle. Others embrace evolution because if God did not create the earth, then we're not accountable to God. And if we're not accountable to God, then we can live however we want. And many who embrace these views really don't know what they teach. They don't know what it's all about. And it's interesting, when you actually talk to people on the street and they tell you what they believe and you reason it out with them, what they believe, and explain to them what they're saying, they're usually shocked. Sometimes they're mad, but usually they're like, I never really thought about it that way. Basically, they're saying, I never realized that I wasn't using my brain until right now. And you pointed it out to me in a nice, loving way. And I feel kind of stupid, but I want to change. And honestly, that's one of the number one ways that I witness to people. I ask people, hey, what do you believe? I'm not going to tell you what I believe. What do you believe? And I'll let them just talk. Well, I believe this. And usually they don't know what they believe. So they kind of like make it up as they go. Well, I kind of think that God is like this. And he kind of, I don't know, I guess. And they really, you can tell they're like a parent making up a bedtime story for their kid. They're just kind of making up as they go. They're like, oh, maybe, yeah. Maybe he gives gumdrops and lollipops to kids when they're good. I don't know. He's cool. And they make up their own story about God. And when you reiterate that story to them, they kind of go, okay, that doesn't make sense. But we always substitute something when we take God out of the place that he's supposed to be in our lives. And whether that's something someone's given to us, or whether it's something that we've created for ourselves, we always put something else in that place. Number four, failing to glorify God, and failing to be thankful to God, not only produces idolatry, but soon it produces degenerate living as well. Showing the decline that sin can bring, it begins with unthankfulness and indifference, resulting in the dropping of standards. The radical downward trend begins in the realm of our thinking. And so that you can really trace our problems in our personal lives, society, and our country, you can really trace it to a failure to worship the true God. You know, I've found in counseling situations, dealing with people who are really messed up, have a lot of things in their life, no one ever comes into my office and they never tell me, well, one minute I was a Christian and the next minute I decided I wanted to become a crack whore. And I just did it. I've never heard that to this day. I've never heard someone tell me that they just decided to wake up and become this person that they never dreamt of. That never happens. No one ever just decides to be a murderer. Hey, I'm going to murder people today. Yeah, I've been going to church for the past 20 years, but I'm going to just murder people. It's going to be awesome. No one ever does that. No one wakes up and says, you know what? I'm going to do a profuse amount of cocaine this morning. I've never done it before, but I'm going to do it right now. That doesn't happen. It's a downward spiral. It's a trend. It starts with our thinking. It starts with not realizing who God is or what he's done and dropping our standards just a little bit and saying, you know what? This person that's been asking me to do this thing that I'm uncomfortable with, I'll give it a try and I'll see what happens. And then our standard drops just a little bit. And they would say, you know what? That was okay. It didn't really hurt me. It was kind of fun. I want to try it again. And we'll try something else. And we'll get lower and lower and lower until we're at the bottom of the barrel looking up saying, how did I get myself in this situation? I got to tell you, it's heartbreaking. I talk to girls that come in and they're involved in numerous sexual relationships and drugs, and they always tell me it started out with that one guy who asked them to do something that they were uncomfortable with. Or I talk to people who are addicted to drugs and having to go to rehab and boot camps and all these things, and they always say it started with my friend offering me a cigarette. He offered me one cigarette and I did it, and it led to all this other stuff. It led to me accepting a marijuana joint. It led to me accepting a hit of a drug that I didn't know what it was. It led to me doing this and doing this and doing that. And it's a downward spiral into a degenerate lifestyle. We have pushed God out of the classroom. We've pushed God out of the courtroom. We've pushed God out of our country. Recently, President Obama said at a public appearance that this is no longer a Christian nation. A nation that was founded on Christian principles, he said it is no longer a Christian nation. We as a country, we as a group of individuals have pushed God out of the classroom, the courtroom, and our country. We've pushed aside his standards that he gives us as protection. And we've even rewritten our own history when we should really be focusing on what he's done for us. And now our country's reaping the inevitable results. The family is under increasing attack. The divorce rate's higher than it's ever been. We have a failing education system. It continues to get worse. We have rampant violent crime, a drug epidemic with no end in sight. Sexual perversion all around, even being flaunted and pushed upon us through the media and television. It's like Pandora's box. But it always starts with the thinking. Think about it. What was taboo 30 years ago is commonplace today. It's spoken of as acceptable in TV shows, sung about in contemporary music. TV Guide ran a cover story entitled, "What Happened to the Family Television?" And it said this, "Sex, violence, and lewd jokes have invaded early morning viewing." It's no longer late night television, early morning viewing. Find out why shows like Leave It to Beaver seem like ancient history. And I'll be honest, I've never watched an episode of Leave It to Beaver. But it brings up a good point. In one part of the article, they contrasted TV shows of today with TV shows of an earlier time. And it says, then, on the Brady Bunch, Greg feared telling his folks that he wrecked the car. Now, on The Office, Oscar fears telling The Office that he's gay. Then, on Happy Days, sharing some Cokes meant sipping cola through straws from the same glass. Now, on Family Guy, sharing some Coke means a dog snorting an illegal substance through straws with his owners. Then, on Little House on the Prairie, Laura and Nellie, both eager to satisfy their hunger for sweets, fight over the last cookie. Now, on Friends, Monica and Rachel, both eager to satisfy their hunger for sex, fight over the last condom. Things have changed. Culture's changed. Media's changed. Right now, the fifth most popular album in America this week is Marilyn Manson's new album called Born Villain, featuring the following message for teens. Show myself how to make a noose, a gun's cliche and a razor too. I'm not a death share vacation, vacant station, made of scars and filled with my old wounds. You don't even want to know what I'm going to do to you. So take your little black book. I see the way you look into it. I'll eat it. I'll cut my tongue. And on the pages you spread, sweet as honey you said, but I'm choking on your bitter stories, no sin eater to slay, us the children of Cain. We live in a different world. Different things in the media, different things being sung, different things being said, different things being given to us. And this is the peril of failing to worship God. It's only a matter of time until someone or something takes his place. So we've seen in Romans 1 the wrong way to worship. Now let's look at briefly the right way to worship. Turn to John chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. John chapter 12, we're going to look at verses 1 through 8. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 12, John says, "Then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. Then Mary took a pound of very costly oil and spikenard, anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair. And the whole house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, 'Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?' This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the money box, and he used to take what was put in it. But Jesus said, "Let her alone. She has kept this for the day of my burial. For the poor you have with you always, but me you do not always have." Now a great many of the Jews knew that he was there, and they came, not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests plotted to put Lazarus to death also, because on account of him, many of the Jews went away and believed in Jesus. So here we have a story of two people. Mary and Judas. There you go. Mary and Judas. And they both have two different views of how Jesus is to be worshipped. And here you have the tender and touching story of Mary. And as our story begins, you have Martha predictably working, and Mary is worshiping. Martha's being busy. She was always like a busy bee. She was a little homemaker. She was always wanting to make things right. And Mary comes in, and she's not working. She's not doing what a traditional house host should do. But she is doing what the Lord would have her do, and she is worshiping Jesus. She wants to give to Jesus something that is valuable, something that is precious and special. And so with complete abandon, she breaks a bottle of extremely expensive perfume, and she wipes the feet of Jesus. Now, to give you an idea of how expensive this perfume was, it says 300 denarii. In that time period, that would have been 6 months' worth of wages. So this was half a year's pay. So if you think about the average income in New Mexico, I think it's like $26,000. That would be like buying a $13,000 gift to give to somebody. Here you go. I think you're cool. I've never had a gift like that given to me. But here Mary comes with complete abandon, and that which she holds most dear, she gives to Jesus. What most in that area would consider their subject of worth and value, Mary considers nothing before the feet of Jesus. That's quite a gift. And it wasn't just the value of the gift that was so significant. See, Mary could have come and made a bold statement. She could have come and said, "This perfume is worth $13,000. I want you guys to check this out. I'm giving it to Jesus." She could have hired like a mariachi band to play as she came into the house and like given it to Jesus. She could have gotten a stage and she could have done like something really elaborate and exciting as she gave it to Jesus. She could have even said that it was worth more to impress others. This was the sin of Ananias and Sapphira, pretending to be something that they weren't. And yet instead, Mary, with complete abandon, breaks it as though it were nothing. Because, compared to Jesus, it was. Compared to Jesus, it was nothing. Compared to Jesus, it was worthless. When King David bought the field from Ornan, he said, "I will surely buy it for the full price, for I will not take what is yours for the Lord, nor offer burnt offerings with that which costs me nothing." Don't give God your leftovers. Don't give God the end of your week. Give him your best. Give him your best work. Give him your best efforts. Give him your best gifts. Give him that which is your best. This is why I love doing a college ministry and speaking primarily to a younger generation, because we have the best years of our lives to give to God. You know, I've been a pastor for a while, and I've done a lot of hospital visits. And I've seen before people at a very old age, on their deathbed, give their lives to Christ, and it's incredible. It's so cool to see, because you know they're going to be in heaven. But at the same time, I've counseled with a person before on their deathbed who, after receiving Christ, she started crying. And I was puzzled, and I said, "Why are you crying? Are you happy?" And she said, "No, I'm sad." And I was like, "Whoa, you just gave your heart to Jesus. You're going to go to heaven in like a few hours. Why are you sad?" And she said, "I wasted my life. I just received the gift from Jesus, but I wasted my life." We don't want to waste our lives. We want to give the best years of our lives. We want to give the best that we have to the glory of God. We want to worship God with our lives and be a holy and acceptable sacrifice, which is our reasonable service. A little twist in the story. It says that Judas protests the worship. In verse 4 through 6, he says the money should have been given to the poor. And on the surface, it looked like Judas was the true worshiper. I'm sure a couple of the apostles were like, yeah, that's right, Judas, you preach it, brother. Yeah, should be given to the poor. And Mary was the wasteful one. She was the sinner. This reminds us, things aren't always as they seem. I like that John adds it. Hey, by the way, this guy who said that is the one who betrayed Jesus. Yeah, for 30 pieces of silver, not even 300 denarii, 30 pieces. Yeah, real righteous guy. We might be in church. We might see someone with arms outstretched to God, tears running down their cheeks. They sing louder than anyone else. They rise on their tiptoes a bit. And we can look at that person and say, wow, that's worship. That person is really worshiping. And it might be. But at the same time, there might be someone next to them, arms barely raised, maybe not raised at all, no emotional display. And we could easily dismiss them and say, that person must not really be into the worship. Remember, things aren't always as they seem. God looks at our heart. And when we're worshiping God, it's not our place to judge anyone else's worship but our own. And I'll let you know, if you're looking around at people while you're worshiping and judging them, there's a problem with your worship, not theirs. Because you're more focused on how they're giving their gifts to God than you doing something and worshiping. Be focused with your own worship. Now, there's other people who will even sit and worship, and they'll watch the band. I hate this song. Man, I don't like their voice. I hate the sound of that guitar. These lights are so distracting. And they'll pick apart everything without ever worshiping God. You know, I've been in the middle of jungles before with people who have horrible voices, with mosquitoes biting me. And I've seen people genuinely worship God more passionately than I've seen most Americans ever do. And that tells me it's not about the voice, it's not about the band, it's about something deeper. And if it's not about something deeper, then why are we doing it? Once again, if it's just about an experience, take me to a Coldplay concert, please. But if it's about something more, then that's why we're here, to worship the true and living God. We must all be worshipers. We do it because He is worthy. We do it with deep reverence. As we bow down and pay homage to Him, we do it with intimacy as we kiss towards Him. Reverence and intimacy, giving our best. Nothing is too much. Keep in mind, we were created to do this. I'm going to close with this. Revelation 4:11 says, "You are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power. For you have created all things, and for your pleasure they are and were created."